From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potatoes.
And you like potato.
You like tomato.
And you like tomato.
Welcome to the weirdest election of your lifetime and a special edition of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center Inside the Political Circus, coming to you live from the beautiful theater at the Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. As always, we are your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate, now with funkier theme music. I'm Josh Barrow, your host, your center, and your senior editor at Business Insider. Tonight is going to work a bit differently than the show usually does, as we'll first be joined on stage by two political strategists to get us up to the minute on the state of the race. After that, I'll be joined on stage by my left, right, and center cohorts to dissect how we got here, what the effects of Wednesday's debate will be, and what's going to happen over the next 18 days to Election Day. So please join me in welcoming our Democratic pollster, Executive Vice President at PSB Research, and co-host of the top-rated podcast, The Pollsters, Margie Omero. And author, political analyst for CBS News, and former executive director of the White House Initiative on Hispanic Education under George W. Bush, Republican Leslie Sanchez. So let's start in the obvious place. Let's start with you, Margie. Hillary's going to win this thing, right?
It does seem like that, doesn't it? I mean, we've had three debates where she was so much stronger than him. She's been up in the polls nationally in basically every poll aside from the California LA Times poll consistently for months. She's up in most battleground states, and she's brought more states in play, and he hasn't had any other opposing force. So while she put states like Arizona and North Carolina and Georgia in play, even Utah, he hasn't been able to make comparable gains in places like Michigan or Wisconsin that there was once a theory he could. He hasn't been able to do that.
So is this like a 7-point race now? Is it a 9-point race? How far ahead is she?
It's in that range. I mean, there was one poll done at the same time by one news outlet that had her up 4, another one done that had her up 11. It's somewhere in there. We don't know yet. I mean, what the folks at Pew will tell you is, look, you're trying to measure an electorate that doesn't exist yet. We don't know exactly how many people are going to end up voting by Election Day, but it does seem she's up by a lot.
So if she's up by 9 points, that'd be the biggest margin anybody's won a presidential election by since Ronald Reagan in 1984. Leslie, do you agree that that's where we are right now, a really commanding Hillary lead like that?
No. Not yet. It doesn't mean it can't happen. By the way, thank you for inviting me to a room full of Republicans or bad hombres. I don't really know which. Probably both. But it's still, if you argue and if you talk to the folks at Gallup and Pew, there's still so many variables you don't know. Yes, it is a commanding lead. Yes, Trump is underperforming in traditional red states, including Texas and Arizona. But they don't really know who's going to turn out. It gets out to this big get out the vote effort. We know Latinos have been extremely upset with Donald Trump, but they tend to underperform in terms of getting out and executing and submitting the ballot. So there's still some of those variables. So I wouldn't say the spread is that big, but we should know in about 6 or 7 days.
So the 538 model that I assume a lot of you have been refreshing sort of maniacally every day, currently says that Donald Trump has about a 13% chance of winning. And now, on the one hand, that's an overwhelming likelihood of a Hillary win. But 13 isn't that low. Things that are 13% likely to happen about 1 in 8 times, which seems like an uncomfortably high probability.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm upset when he's over 1%. That's upsetting to me.
So what does that 13% consist of? What are those 1 in 8 outcomes in which on November 9 we wake up and Donald Trump isn't conceding because he's actually won the thing?
So, I mean, I guess part of it is just sort of CYA, right? I mean, part of it is we've just gotten everything wrong. Every national poll, every state poll, everything is completely wrong. So we just have there's a little bit of CYA. 100 and zero always means there's something a little bit wrong in your data, right? And nothing is 100% certain.
But so then you're saying the model is overstating the likelihood of a Trump win just to be careful because Nate Silver doesn't want to be caught out saying it's impossible and then it happens?
Well, you probably would have. He might phrase it differently. I think this is where the nuance comes in, right? This is where she's graded on a different curve than he is because it's still 4 to 11%. It's not 20%, right? So that's still a single digit margin in, you know, most polls. And given what we don't know about turnout, given that both candidates are so unpopular, you know, there's still some wiggle room there. Now, that said, voter registration numbers, new registration numbers seem to suggest that Democrats have the edge. There's been some analysis on that. A plurality of new registrants in all the battleground states are Democratic. But, you know, that doesn't mean that analysis is sound or that those people ultimately are going to vote. I mean, there's still a lot that could happen.
Leslie, you said you think we'll know in about 6 days. What are you watching for over the next 6 days?
It gets a lot harder to surpass a 5 to 6 point lead. It's just insurmountable at that point in terms of turnout. And you're looking, of course, like 7 battleground states, right? And you're trying to see what that margin is in those states. So there's a couple of, when she's talking about variables, it is enthusiasm factor. We heard a lot about that. Who's enthusiastic? We know Trump supporters are extremely enthusiastic. We know they've also kind of heard this dog whistle about rigged elections, which is a really meaningful thing I know you're going to get into, but what it's suggesting is that there will be more poll watchers. There will be more people looking at some of these assumptions that 3 and 4 people or people registered in 3 and 4 different places, like you saw in Florida. So there's going to be a lot more critical analysis, I think, with respect to that. And probably the third factor is that there's so many people, particularly in the Latino community, upwards of two-thirds, that say they're voting not for Trump, but just to, you know, basically, not for Hillary, I'm sorry, but against Trump. And anti-votes on Election Day, it's really hard to tell if they're actually going to get out there and do it.
So we talked a little bit about the map. And, you know, these red states that Trump is underperforming in, he hasn't put up the numbers in places like Wisconsin that he'd been hoping for, but he's relatively overperforming in the Midwest. It looks like he'll probably do about as well in Iowa as Romney did, maybe a little better. Is this a realignment election we're having? What does it mean for America if a Republican candidate is doing better in Iowa than in Georgia?
Well, it means a couple things. I don't know if it means a full realignment. I think it means simply he does better in states that have a very low minority population. And that's why states like Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona are potentially in play. That's part of the reason. He simply can't make up enough ground. So education, specifically among whites, is a huge place. It's a huge driver. And if you look at some of these polls where he's doing so well with non-white college-educated men, a lot of attention's been paid to this group. And in some of these polls, it's about a fifth of the electorate, 18-20% of the electorate. He'd have to get every single solitary last white non-college educated man to vote for him and be everywhere he is and be the same place where he is in all the other groups in order to be competitive. But what he needs to do to get that vote, he ends up alienating the other 80%. And I don't know if that's a realignment per se, but it is a change in some of the drivers that make a difference.
Well, I guess, Leslie, the question is this going to follow future Republican candidates? Are they going to run for a map like Trump on a strategy like Trump? Or should we call this election an anomaly and assume that the 2020 map and the 2020 campaign will look more like 2012 than this year?
It's so hard to say, right? You've got the 30% establishment being establishment media and establishment party structure, whether they're Republican or Democrat, that is trying to write this narrative like we are right now. They don't really know what the other 70% are trying to do when they say they want an outsider. He could have, if you look at it this way, people say wrong track for the country. They want an outsider. They don't support the status quo. It was an open runway for a solid Republican candidate to move. I don't think you're going to see, God help us, another candidate like this one. I don't know if we can survive. There's not enough hair color in the world for the gray. But I will say, what's interesting, she talked about voter registration. We lived through the primary. You know, there were so many of us, I'll call myself establishment Republican, who saw the increases in conservative Democrats that felt disaffected, you know, completely affected by trade issues and such, that came out and registered by the hundreds of thousands in states like Pennsylvania, or switched their party ID. So we didn't know what was happening. But the only thing I can mirror this to is Barry Goldwater, 1964. We know there were 5 books written about the extinction, use that word, the extinction of the Republican Party, and 24 months later we won 50 seats in the House and then went on to continue to have big victories. So these are wake-up calls for the party, and they do really shape the future.
What is the role of third-party candidates going to be in this election? I mean, there had been, you know, it looked like we were going to have a record level, or not a record level, but an unusually high level of third-party support. There's been some softening in poll numbers for Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. Evan McMullen now is polling such that he might actually win the state of Utah. Do you think that we're going to see substantial Johnson-Stein vote, or is this going to collapse into a sort of normal two-party vote in 49 of the states except Utah?
So I think there was this theory that Bernie Sanders voters were going to rush to Johnson or Stein. I never really saw that as a potential. Democrats were more united behind Clinton in May than and in June than Democrats were united behind Obama in 2008. So I was always suspicious of this theory, and that's turned out to be true, that Democrats, you know, very much have coalesced behind Clinton. And you could see it with, you know, Johnson really had so many gaffes. The only time he's made news is been with his gaffes, and that really prevented him from taking off.
What is Aleppo?
Exactly. And in fact, Aleppo, you probably saw, was one of the most searched words. Not Aleppo. What is Aleppo? That was one of the most
searched. It's a type of cheetah.
Searched during one of the debates. So anyway, So I don't really see that that's going to take off. Evan McMullen's the one to watch, because he gives a credible, you know, he's got a well-respected ticket that gives, at least in Utah, some vote Republicans to say, I have a place to go.
And then what about Congress? Because Democrats are starting to get hopeful that they can actually take back both houses. Now, the way the map lays out, Democrats have to do really well, maybe win nationally by something like 7 or 8 points, to take back the majority in the House of Representatives. Leslie, you're shaking your head.
Yeah,
you don't think they have any hope of that?
It would have to be such a massive, and I think there's been a lot of calculus behind that, it would be such a massive wave, which I think many are hoping for, but because of the unlikability factors and all those other factors we talk about, we just don't see that.
Margie, what do you think?
I mean, look, the Senate, if for a while, the upshot, New York Times, they have a forecaster for the Senate. And there was a moment, I think, in the last 2 weeks where they had Republicans holding on to the Senate rather than Democrats. That shifted now back to Democrats having the edge because of some changes in Nevada, for example, North Carolina, some states that have moved. Then you have Republicans in Pennsylvania like Pat Toomey, who, you know, he's been trying to woo the other side now for a while. He didn't have an election year conversion. He's been working at it for a while. So I think the Senate is now, you know, it leans Democratic, but we'll see on election night. The House, you know, these things break late. So it's not impossible. I mean, you're expecting, you know, on the one hand, split House districts are hard to find. There aren't many districts that have voted for a different party for a member of the House as they did for president. That's been getting increasingly true now for a while. On the other hand, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to have, you know, really disaffected Republican voters. I mean, they're not going to want to come out and vote, and then that's going to hurt everyone down the ticket. This has been something that Republicans have been fearing for a while.
Yeah, isn't that with, you know, the fight between Donald Trump and Paul Ryan, and Trump out there saying, well, the election is rigged? Aren't some Republicans who are either not keen on Trump or not keen on Ryan and his House caucus and wondering if the election even really matters? Isn't the risk that some of them won't show up and that'll hand the House to Democrats?
Well, I think there's been a lot of pushback, as there should be, by Republicans on this rigged thing, you know, and the impact that it will have both ways. I think what's important in the context of that, that's a political tactic and a very shrewd one, but it's not a presidential one. And there's been so much written in the press about, and I'm kind of taking it a different direction, about how it's so unpresidential. Trump is a lot of things, but he's not presidential. so I wouldn't give him that all of a sudden breaking late to be presidential. But he, it is certainly a stressful point, no doubt, for Republican leadership, who have all, for over a year, have been trying to figure out how to navigate.
And they haven't given their own voters a clear message about how they should feel. They're getting mixed messages. I mean, candidates down the ballot are themselves giving mixed messages. The party is giving a mixed message. People are saying, well, I don't endorse him, but I'm voting for him, and you should do what you want. I mean, it's, if you're a voter, how do you make heads or tails of that?
There's a fascinating point to this, and it does come up in some mostly qualitative data, and that has to do with the fact that many feel that Republicans lost their backbone here, that they should have stood behind the nominee. We understand all the issues surrounding that, but that they should have had a backbone in both policy ideas that they were moving an agenda forward, like Speaker Ryan's trying to do, but also that they stood for something, that they weren't just 10% different from the Democrats. And that's why you have so many frustrated with both Republican and Democratic.
I want to finally ask Leslie about, so you have Republicans torn in this way. Republican voters clearly want House Republicans, Senate Republicans, a majority of them want them to stay with Donald Trump. But I think they're afraid of the long-term impact on them and on the Republican Party. And here in California, people talk a lot about Prop 187 and Pete Wilson and anti-immigration politics that was seen as helpful at the time for helping Pete Wilson get reelected as governor of California. People blame that for the demise, essentially, of the Republican Party here in California, alienating Hispanic voters as the state's demographics changed, making it impossible to build durable majorities. Do Republicans need to worry that that's happening nationally now?
Absolutely. It was a generational impact in California. With the exception of 1 year, Republicans have lost seats in the state legislature ever since that passed. So you can't look at the data and just dispute that in any way. Nationally, and I will even say anecdotally, I've talked to Gen Z, Generation Z, which are like young, you know, tween high school kids in California, outside of LA. And the only thing they know about the Republican Party is they don't know a lot about who's the elephant and the donkey or this and that, but they know Trump and they know he's a racist. And these are things I've said to members of Congress and leadership, and I'm like, we have some serious problems, because you can lose a generation of children who are not even close, who are 5-6 years away from actually being eligible to vote, just based on social media and what they think of our party.
Well, that is a sobering message for Paul Ryan, certainly between a rock and a hard place. Well, that's the state of the race. I want to thank Margie O'Meara and Leslie Sanchez for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Once again, I am Josh Barrow, your host of this special Left, Right, and Center. It's now time to welcome our Left, Right, and Center panel onto the stage. Now, please hold your applause in the theater until everybody has been seated. On the left tonight is Gene Sperling. He directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama, and he's also been advising Hillary Clinton. Mona Charon is on the right. She's a nationally syndicated columnist and a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Kelly Goff is our special guest. She's a columnist for the Daily Beast and host of the WNYC series Political Party with Kelly Goff. And finally, because tonight is not your typical Left, Right, and Center, and this is definitely not your typical election, we have a second special guest, Mickey Kaus. He's a longtime political blogger at KausFiles.com. He's a Democrat, and he is still insisting, for whatever reason, that he might vote for Donald Trump. Let's welcome our panel. So there has been some news tonight, sort of just before we're going to air. The Al Smith Dinner is a dinner for Catholic charities in New York, and it's traditionally the last event where the two presidential candidates appear together on stage. And they're supposed to make lighthearted jokes at their own expense and sort of rib each other in a way that's fun and suggests we can all be friends at the end of this. If you're here in the audience in the theater, you probably didn't see it on TV, but I can assure you it went approximately as you would have expected it to go. Donald Trump actually got booed, which and cheering for the booing, I see. He got booed for calling Hillary corrupt and various other things. Clinton did not get booed, but she was extremely pointed in a way that I think was clearly trying to draw a reaction out of Trump. We have a little bit of sound from the two candidates at that dinner.
Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary, you or I. For example, here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics.
People look at the Statue of Liberty and they see a proud symbol of our history as a nation of immigrants, a beacon of hope for people around the world. Donald looks at the Statue of Liberty and sees a four.
So I find this funny in light of what Donald Trump said at Wednesday's debate about Hillary being such a nasty woman, because Donald Trump is by far the nastiest presidential candidate of my lifetime. And as I watch this election, yes, yeah, I know, we all think Donald Trump is nasty. We don't have to congratulate ourselves for that. Aside from all the policy, I feel like one of the biggest effects of this campaign has just been the way that it's affected the discourse and the way that it is, the example that it has set for the way people treat each other. And so I guess I want to ask Mona first, because when I look at this, I see that Donald Trump won the primary in part because what a lot of Republican voters wanted was someone who was nasty. That they saw that political correctness had been using norms of politeness to write certain ideas out of society that they held. And the reaction has been basically that politeness itself is a problem. And I guess my question is, do you agree with that diagnosis? And as someone who I assume does value politeness, how do you feel about that in your political coalition? What is there to do about that after this election?
Wow, just a small little question to start off with there, Josh. So first of all, there are many things that contributed to the rise of Trump. I think it would be too simple to say that it was simply that people were tired of political correctness. There is a sense that the media are very biased, and of course they have been for a very long time. That doesn't justify the Trump approach of basically taking a howitzer and aiming it in every possible direction. But I do think that the conservative media, and by that I include talk radio, Fox News, Heritage Action, other groups, have prepared the ground in the sense that they have imitated the left. The left has traditionally been the parties in this country who have encouraged people to see themselves as victims. Now Trump has taken it and done it to the right. He's made people on the right say, we are actually the real victims. White working class people are the ones who are really discriminated against. We have our grievances and we want them to be heard, and here's our spokesman.
Mickey, I know you feel strongly about immigration, and you've made a policy-related case around the, not necessarily for making Trump president, but the benefits of Trump. But before we get into that, I want to ask about this civility issue. Does this worry you, both the endorsement of nastiness and the endorsement of this idea of white working class victimhood? Is this a problem?
Well, it worries me. It's part of the coarsening of the culture that's been going on long before Trump. I mean, Trump is just the culmination. But the white working class is sort of the victim of the current economy. If you look at wages, where are wages stagnant? They're stagnant at the bottom with workers who didn't go to college. So it's totally legitimate for people, those people, to have a grievance. And it's totally legitimate for them to seek to redress that grievance through the ballot box. Trump isn't my ideal personality, but I'm for the issue is not the man.
Kelly, what do you make of the Trump nastiness personality in our politics? Do you worry? Because I hear from a lot of people on the right, they sort of talk about this as like it happened to the right and it could happen to the left next, and the left's Trump and worrying about this happening. But I don't really see this as a both sides thing, do you?
No, I think there's a lot of, first of all, I want to start by saying there's a lot of blame to go around for the rise of Donald Trump. And I think that goes from conservative media that championed him. I think that goes to mainstream media. I know Les Moonves recently clarified or attempted to clarify his remarks. But I don't know that I think he was joking when he said months ago when he said that Donald Trump may be bad for America, but he's great for ratings. And so I think...
Exactly.
Les, are you in the audience? No, so... but no, so I think there's a lot of blame to go around, but I do want to point out that when the University of Chicago issued that letter finally saying, look, we want to explain to students that you don't have a right to only hear what you want to essentially at college. I mean, I'm obviously oversimplifying this long letter. That letter was cheered not just by conservatives, but by a lot of high-profile liberals, including Jonathan Alter. So there is a sense in society that on the one hand, people feel the freedom to be more offensive than ever. I mean, that's what Donald Trump is all about, right, in terms of how he talks about Hispanics, how he talks about Muslims. But on the other hand, as Andrew Sullivan really put so perfectly in a piece for New York Magazine, if you are an unemployed white male who most of your friends are also unemployed, don't have jobs, families living in poverty in rural America, you don't want to turn on your television and see an African American at an Ivy League university chanting at you about your privilege. There is room to empathize with both sides, and I think what I'm worried about is that we're getting away from seeing empathy for all types of people in this country, and that's what I think he's really damaged. That's, to me, the worst damage that Donald Trump has done.
I want to push back on that a little bit, in that the typical Donald Trump supporter is not an unemployed white person in coal country whose job has been lost to technological change or restrictions on coal. The typical Donald Trump supporter is wealthier than the average American. It doesn't his demographic does not skew as wealthy as the typical Republican candidate's does.
But it also depends on where you are, Josh. It does depend on in terms of the state breakdown of who's supporting him. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but so I think while there are a lot of people out there with legitimate grievances, it also seems to me that the grievance politics he has put out has been quite popular with people low on the socioeconomic spectrum and also in many cases high on the socioeconomic spectrum.
But I want to be clear. I don't think he has solutions for those people. I think what he's doing is he is exploiting those people's legitimate concerns for his own political expediency. I don't think that Donald Trump has a plan or empathy for really anybody except Donald Trump.
Look, there. As I see it, there are three trends driving, and Gene can correct me, three trends driving down the wages of unskilled people. There's global trade, there's immigration, competition from other unskilled workers, and there's automation, which is basically rendering their jobs obsolete. Trump does have answers to two of those. He wants to moderate trade, and he wants to pause or, you know, slow down immigration. Those are answers. For if you worry about wages at the bottom, those are answers. You may disagree with them, but they're answers.
Those are not answers. The idea that working class people can get their jobs back because the factory closed due to NAFTA, and that Donald Trump is going to wave a magic wand, declare trade wars on Mexico and Canada and the rest of the world, China, and that somehow those factories are going to come back is complete fantasy. Those factories, first of all, mostly are not employing working class people because they're automated, not because of international trade. And there's absolutely no way that you can roll back the clock on something like that. And telling people that you can is feeding them a fantasy and a myth, and that is not productive.
Gene, I want to get you in on this, because I'm interested, because I mean, the candidate you're advising has a significantly more skeptical position on trade than she has had in previous campaigns. Is a more restrictive posture on trade part of the answer for raising wages?
Well, listen, Josh, I feel like I need to respond to what's been said so far, because I think it is exceedingly too kind to the rise of Donald Trump. There is a very legitimate discussion about how our economy has been working for typical Americans. And I think Hillary Clinton, as much as anyone, thinks that, particularly over the last 15 years, we've had too much income inequality, there's been too much wage stagnation, there's real issues there. But Donald Trump hasn't just been about a kind of, you know, tell it like it is talk on these issues. It hasn't been just about attacking political correctness. This is a person who has taken the most destructive pattern of divisiveness that hurts countries and leads to discrimination historically throughout the world, but rarely have you seen this in the United States. This is somebody who takes that unhappiness and instead of trying to have a real policy discussion, tries to tell you it's because Mexicans are rapists and criminals. It's because Muslims are going to come into our country. We need to ban them. It is denigrating women. It is about winking to David Duke and not responding for 36, 48 hours. This has been, I think Hillary Clinton hit it very well yesterday, a dark pattern of divisiveness. And this is an attack on Donald Trump. It does not have to be an attack on the entire Republican Party, because there are Republicans who have stood up to him. And I want to say that I've been involved in 7-8 presidential elections, and I have never felt this way about our opponents. John McCain stopped a woman from demeaning Barack Obama in the middle of a competitive campaign. George W. Bush went in the first week after 9/11 and went to mosques and said, these are Muslim Americans. This is what leaders do regardless of how you disagree on policy. When you are divided, you ask people to reach for their better angels and pull people together. And Donald Trump's entire campaign has been about demeaning and dividing, and it's a terrible thing, and I hope I hope that the Republican Party rises up above it. It will make them more competitive in the next election, but it will be good for all of us.
The problem is nobody else is willing to say maybe we should pause immigration or maybe we shouldn't have an amnesty that encourages more people to come, except Donald Trump. He had 17 opponents. None of them were willing to say it. If one of them was willing to say it, I would have supported them. But it was 0 for 17. So we're left with Donald Trump.
Absolutely not
because
true.
Because that policy is wrong. The fact that you have what Hillary Clinton said last night, undocumented workers living in the shadow, leads to their exploitation. It drives the wages down not only of the immigrants, but of other workers. When they come out of the shadows, they can compete. That helps all workers. And his issue is not about the flood of workers, because that's not of illegal immigration, because that's not happening. It is about deporting 11 million people who live here in our country, who have ripped families apart. He has talked about it in the last 3 weeks. You are dignifying his proposals far too much. This is about someone who's called for deportation squads and won the Republican nomination.
The deportation squad has been put in a file cabinet in the Department of Homeland Security. It's not an important factor
anymore. So
WikiLeaks will have it next week.
Yeah, here's what I'd say about this. Is first what Mona just said, which is that, you know, Donald Trump says he changed his immigration policy, but he changes all the time. If you were to make him president, he could do something completely different from what he said. But aside from that, you do have this shift where Donald Trump came out of the gate about Mexican rapists and build the wall and make Mexico pay for it. And then when he finally issued a really detailed immigration policy, it looked quite different from that. Because when you get serious immigration skeptical policy experts in a room writing something down, they don't write build the wall and make Mexico pay for it.
Well, he still wants to build the wall, but he shifted to an enforcement first strategy, right, which is the strategy that Gene won't consider, which is you do the things necessary to secure the border, and then we can have an amnesty that brings people out of the shadows, but we won't have another wave of 20 million people.
But the thing is, that is not what has defined his candidacy, and that is not what he says out on the stump.
It's what Mitt Romney ran on 4 years ago. This is the funny, we don't need to theorize about what it would be like to have a candidate who had a pretty strongly immigration skeptical policy without all of this nasty rhetoric. And the thing is, Mitt Romney's policy, which I think is roughly what you want, Mickey, did not seem to connect with the base that is allegedly so interested in a restrictive immigration policy to raise wages. And so the only thing I can conclude from that is that the voters who are so excited about Trumpism, setting aside the merits of a restrictive immigration policy, and I'm open-minded about how that affects wages, I think it's unclear, but the voter interest in restricting immigration doesn't seem to be about wages and the American worker. It seems to be about not liking brown people.
Romney was pretty wishy-washy. He was strong in the primary and then wussy in the general election, so I don't think he's a fair test.
This was the greatest missed opportunity in political history. It is political malpractice of an unbelievable dimension that you had this setup for the Republican Party. You had 8 years of Obama, the economy is sluggish, people were ready for a change. They usually are after an eight-year period of one party in power. Hillary Clinton is the second most distrusted and disliked politician in America. And you had this opportunity for Republicans to step up. They already had the House and the Senate. They already had most state legislatures. Democrats had lost 1,000 elected officials during the period that Obama was president. Okay, so they were sliding into a trough. And what did what needed to happen? Republicans just needed to nominate someone who didn't frighten the horses, okay? That's all they needed to do.
Kelly, quickly.
Yeah. No, I'm good.
Let's turn a little bit and talk about last night's debate. You are once again listening to Left, Right, and Center on KCRW. I'm Josh Barrow. I'm here with Gene Sperling, Mickey Kaus, Kelly Goff, and Mona Charon. Let's go down the line. Gene, what was your big takeaway from Wednesday's debate?
You know, I know I should be commenting as an economic advisor on the economic discussion, but I thought the most powerful moment in that debate, and I thought one of the most impressive things I've ever seen in debate, is how Hillary Clinton handled the whole issue of the women accusers, the Hollywood access issues. Note what she did. She did not get into things that were accused of him. She did not go into things that happened years ago. She went into what he has said in this campaign, how he has, as she said, belittled women, belittled their dignity to make him feel larger. And she went on and she said, and I remember at one point she says that, you know, he suggested that some women were not good looking enough to be worthy of his sexual assault. And when he pulled his Alex Baldwin imitation and tried to go wrong, she kept going.
Alec Baldwin, I think.
Alec Baldwin, yeah. And she went forward, she quoted him specifically. She said, "Look at her. I don't think so." So as he tried to interrupt, she was talking only about the words that he has said. And when she came back after his reply, she went on to kind of say that this is a pattern of divisiveness and a pattern of taking lack of responsibility. And she talked about the con. She talked about what he said about McCain. She talked about undermining a judge, a judge who's born in Indiana, who's Mexican, who is a true American hero, and talked about this pattern of divisiveness. And I thought it was very powerful because none of it was about accusations of the past. It was all using his own words of belittling women, a pattern of divisiveness, and a pattern of never taking responsibility for the things he says.
Kelly?
Yeah, but I think we also know that part of why she didn't go tit for tat on the allegations is because of her husband, right? And I think that if social media had existed in the way that it did when Bill Clinton ran for president, that election might have had a very different outcome. When we have, you know, feminist leaders who start hashtags regarding, you know, allegations that women make about men behaving inappropriately with them. So I think that's part of why she talked about the other ways in which he's demeaned people. I would say, though, for me, this was actually, I never thought I would say this because I was so debated out after the first two, that was actually the best debate in terms of substance and policy. The fact that we've gone through two debates without actually hearing a serious conversation about reproductive rights in this country, and last night was the first time we did. I thought the way, the passion with which she spoke about that issue, to me, was one of the shining moments in the debates where we really see, like, we could have the first female president. And she's standing on a debate stage having a conversation with a man who's judging women who sometimes have to terminate pregnancies because they're facing the possibility of losing their own life or the life of their child. And he's having this conversation about how he knows more about the issue with a woman who's actually carried a baby. I just thought it was a really kind of powerful moment. And for me, that and when he called her a nasty woman, I actually expected her to change her slogan from "I'm with her" to "I'm with nasty," because it was sort of like every woman in America related to being called nasty for simply, you know, I don't know, speaking their mind or disagreeing with a male in their office or something. So, yeah.
Mickey, what was your takeaway?
I guess I'm conditioned by the Schwarzenegger race. Schwarzenegger, like Trump, is a pig, a male chauvinist pig. And if you're judging them on who's the better person, I mean, Trump loses every time. And he showed that even last night, as you pointed out, Josh. He talked about himself a lot when he shouldn't have talked about himself. But there are bigger issues at stake than who's a better person. And in California, we elected Schwarzenegger because even though he was obviously a pig, we thought he had some leadership qualities that would help the state. Similarly, there are big issues that were ventilated in the debate, trade, immigration, some other, the Supreme Court, some other issues that I think transcend, you know, Trump's character, which is awful.
Can I just say, though, Mickey, I think that's something you have the luxury of saying as a white male. I mean, you know, I don't dislike you as a white male. I have plenty of white male friends. Some of them are in the audience tonight. But
some of your best friends are white.
Some of my best friends are white males. That's right. But I have had this back and forth before sometimes with them about, like, those aren't really important issues. It's like, well, yeah, actually being able to have birth control covered is kind of important to someone like me, or, you know, worrying about whether or not I can sue an employer who discriminates against me is kind of important to someone like me. And perhaps if I were not a black female, I would also say that the only issues I vote on are things like trade, but I have to think about other things.
I guess, Mickey, on that point, I mean, even to take immigration, for example, even if we think that Trump's, you know, stated immigration policy, and even if we believe that he will enact it, it's sort of reducible to what Mitt Romney was running on. If you are a person of Mexican descent, wouldn't you find it concerning that he was out there saying all these things about that, you know, Mexico is sending us their worst people and their rapists, even if it had no direct policy implications? Isn't that something people should worry about?
Sure, and Trump could have done a lot of things, I think, to make it clear that he wasn't anti-Latino, and he hasn't really done them, and that's been a huge disappointment.
Well, he's kind of done the opposite.
The contrary.
But Mickey, that isn't just about whether he's a good or bad person or you like his character. You know, my parents raised me to think those are first-order issues, whether you're for discrimination against people with disabilities or by their ethnicity or race. That's not a second order. That's not just like you slur or tell bad jokes or don't have table manners. That's a first-order issue about what kind of country you are. That to me, if you can't get over that hurdle, you do not deserve to be president of the United States.
If I thought Trump was in favor of discrimination, obviously he'd be beyond the pale. But for example, on birth control, I think he's a closet liberal. He opened the campaign by saying nice things about Planned Parenthood. Sorry?
He opened the campaign.
I have a feeling he supports birth control a lot, but it'd be his policies.
Exactly.
Reflect, you know.
I want to get Mona in on the debate.
I don't think this was a debate about issues at all. Hillary Clinton sidestepped a lot of the most important questions. She was able each time to return the topic to Trump and his disabilities. And I agree they are disabilities. I mean, he is the only Republican who was running this year that she could beat. And she's doing it. And she's doing it very simply by going right at him on all of his vulnerabilities, and they are legion. And so whether it's his character, whether it's his behavior toward women, his boorish and loutish conduct toward other human beings, like the handicapped, minority groups, you name it. And she took full advantage of that. She had done her homework, a student, Hillary, she had done her homework. And so he is the most vulnerable and biggest target you can possibly imagine. But did she account for, I mean, she spoke gibberish last night on a lot of things. Let's face it. She was asked about the economy. She said, I want to build the economy from the middle out. I think that's how you get growth. She said, corporations need to pay more. We have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. And she's proposing to raise it even further. Her policies don't hold up, but she was not questioned about them. She wasn't really challenged very much because she had that huge target, that orange target standing there.
That, that is
that
a...
She could,
That is an unfortunate rewriting of what has been this campaign.
Gina, I'll come to you on this in 1 second. Yeah. I want to talk about one more thing on the debate, and then I want to talk about what we spend so much time talking about Trump, but Hillary's going to win this election. So I do want to talk at the end about what she'll actually do.
But Josh, I want to note that Hillary Clinton was running and has run the most substantive campaign, was actually made fun of for the degree of detail she's put out on policy. Read the transcript yesterday about when she came to the economic answer. She talked about infrastructure, manufacturing, small business, clean energy, things that matter. And middle class out, you may think that's ridiculous, but I'll tell you what's ridiculous. After all the inequality we've had, Donald Trump has put forward a tax cut that would give, and this is, you can check the Tax Policy Center and the Tax Foundation, would give more tax relief to the top 1% than the bottom 99% combined. So Hillary Clinton's philosophy is that if you strengthen the middle class and poor families so they make more wages and you invest, they have more income and they have more demand, and that leads to more economic growth. And you may not agree with it, but to consider
strengthen the middle class.
Because when you have a tighter labor market by investing in infrastructure, that means more people have jobs. That means there's higher wages. There's higher wages. She does tax people who are in the top 1%, and she's very clear about it. And she uses that money for public investment in infrastructure, manufacturing, debt-free college, free tuition, paid family leave, things that are important to the middle class.
The rich
and things. And things, Mona, that would lead people to have to come back into the labor force, make more money. And yes, people who are middle income and lower income, when they have higher wages, are more likely to spend it. That increases economic growth.
Everybody
that increases economic demand.
Wages,
and it sure has worked a lot better than the continued failed trickle-down economics of George Bush and Ronald Reagan.
I want to turn to one other thing. Because we talked so much about what happened in the debate, and we didn't talk about the thing that people have been talking about the most today, which is Donald Trump refusing to say that he will accept the result of the election as it is decided. And he's continued saying that today. I want to play a little bit of sound from Trump at a rally in Ohio addressing the concerns he created yesterday.
I would like to promise and pledge to all of my voters and supporters and to all of the people of the United States that I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election if I win.
So it's funny. Is it also scary? I mean, I think we're trying to figure out what's going to happen on November 9 if he comes out and says, it was rigged, she stole it from me like the Emmys, and it was Donna Brazile and Roland Martin in the conservatory with the emails. What's going to happen if he doesn't concede? Because my base case expectation is that he'll sort of be laughed at and it won't actually matter that much. But on the other hand, if there's, you know, a 5 or 10% chance that it's not that and there's real unrest, that's too much.
In fact, later in that speech, he made it clear that absent fraud, he would accept the result even if he lost.
Well,
so it's a little deceptive he said he needs clear evidence that
the election was fairly decided, and he's the guy who ran around for 5 years saying he didn't have clear evidence that Barack Obama was born in Hawaii.
If he does that,
I don't trust his standard on that.
If he does that, I think he's deluded if he thinks he's going to be taken seriously. If he thinks he's going to lose, start a grievance movement and somehow get 40% of the American population behind him, he's insane. People are going to be really furious at him if he loses, and he's going to basically fade away.
Look, Kelly.
Well, look, we chuckled at that clip because at this point we're laughing to keep from crying, I think, about this whole situation. But let me say this. I mean, as someone who's written quite a bit about hate groups, hate groups really reached a peak under President Obama's first term. In fact, there was so much traffic on to different hate group websites that some of them crashed, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, because so many people were looking to join them after President Obama got inaugurated, which is terrifying. And yet they kept going up, 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 hitting a peak in 2011. I think it was the highest of hate group membership in America in like 20 years before that. Then it started to go down again. Well, guess what? it started to creep back up again over the last year. After going down since 2011, it's crept back up in the last year. So on the one hand, it's funny, except that it's not. The reason David Duke is making a comeback is in large part because of Donald Trump. And so there is something rather terrifying about the fact that we have hate groups on the rise and Donald Trump spreading a message of, we don't have to accept the outcome of an election. I mean, I've had friends who have said privately that they were worried when President Obama did his walk after his inauguration, and they're just as worried about Hillary Clinton taking her walk down, during that motorcade after inauguration. It's scary.
So we all agree about how reprehensible Trump is, but I have a slightly different take on this particular issue. I agree completely that it is highly irresponsible for any leader to suggest that he would not abide by the results of an election. That is un-American, I would say, and dangerous. But he is not the only one who traffics in this kind of undermining of the public's confidence in our institutions. Last night, Hillary Clinton did it too, and everyone missed it. It was in her first answer on the Supreme Court. And what did she say? She said she wanted to appoint justices to the Supreme Court who would overturn Citizens United because it was undermining our democracy, that decision, claiming that it was, she told all kinds of stories about it. All right, she may not agree with Citizens United. I think it protected the First Amendment. But for her to say it's undermining our democracy is the kind of hyperbolic speech that that leads people to mistrust institutions. And she also, Bernie Sanders, has done the same thing. He has suggested you are, and Elizabeth Warren, the system is rigged against you. It's the rich against the little guy. You have no chance in this society. The system is unjust. And that kind of rhetoric is also, I'm not going to say it's quite the same as what Trump is doing, but it is also very undermining and irresponsible.
Gina, I want to ask you, related to that, and we're almost 8 years into the Obama administration. The at least implicit idea behind the Clinton campaign is that the system is working pretty well, even if it could work better, and she has ideas about how to make it better. Are establishmentarians generally, and Democrats specifically, since Democrats are in power, not making the case enough that the system actually mostly works? And then what is her presidency going to look like in terms of trying to make it work better, in the sense that I and a lot of people have been going into this assuming that, like Barack Obama, she'll be up against a Republican Congress that will be as obstructionist as possible. If there is this wave, and if Republicans are disaffected enough to stay home, she may be coming in with a Democratic Congress, which opens a lot of those horizons. So what's that going to look like in terms of, not to reference Veep, but continuity with change? What is that going to look like in a Clinton administration?
Well, the way I look at it is, if you have somebody who's extremely sick and they get much better, that's a lot of improvement. It doesn't necessarily mean they're perfectly well. A football team that's 0-16 that goes to 9-7 has shown great improvement. I think that Barack Obama obviously inherited an unspeakable financial crisis. I think we were on the verge of a Great Depression. And so to acknowledge that he has done, that he made bold decisions that helped take us out of that great recession, that we've created 15 million jobs, that despite at times a recalcitrant Congress, he has made progress, is not the same thing as saying that everything is honky-dory. And I think that has never been, first of all, having worked for both President Obama and Hillary Clinton, that's not how either of them look at things. And right now, we still have communities that are hurt, places like Detroit that need more help, turning blight into revitalization, people who are long-term unemployed, who face forms of discrimination that may not be intentional but keep them from even getting interviews and chances, people in our society who've maybe never had their first chance, or people coming out of prison, or young people who never have the opportunity or all the help some of our children do in going to colleges. These are real serious challenges. And I think what's different for Hillary Clinton is that at least she has the opportunity to come and zero in on some of these structural issues. Where with Barack Obama, I think he very much wanted his presidency to be about that, but he had to put his major focus on getting us out of this great financial crisis. Now, he did at least have 2 years. That, well, because a lot of people think that the fact that tens of millions of people don't have health care is a real problem in our country, Mona. And there's a lot of other people who think that having people not be able to get health care because they have a child with autism or a spouse with a heart condition or a pre-existing condition is a real problem. And he thought, Mona, he thought that this would be helping middle-class families and that this was actually an extremely important economic issue. If you think of economic issues about the security and dignity of American families being able to raise their children with a sense of security.
And it would be nice if those premiums really were, as he promised, coming down by an average of $2,500 per family. But the absolute opposite is the case. Everything that Obama promised, that you would be able to keep your doctor, that your premiums would come down,
it's all just Donald Trump hack talk right now.
I unfortunately have to cut it off there. We will devote a lot of attention to health policy when in about 3 weeks our shows will no longer be mostly about Donald Trump. I'm very excited to talk about policy. It is time for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Mona Charon, it's your soapbox.
So this is not exactly a peeve. It's more of a congratulations to the students at Liberty University. Liberty University's chancellor is Jerry Falwell Jr., who has beclowned himself by traveling around the country on behalf of Donald Trump. The students at the university banded together and issued a statement saying, "Associating any politician with Christianity is damaging, but Donald Trump is not just any politician. He has made his name maligning others and bragging about his sins. Not only is Donald Trump a bad candidate for president, he is actively promoting the very things we as Christians ought to oppose." Unquote. Hooray for the students.
Kelly Goff.
We live in an age in which we're pretty used to people in power offering the qualified non-apology of, "I'm sorry you were offended." So I want to issue both a props simultaneous rant, which is that I want to give credit to those who actually apologize when it's needed. And one of those is the Senator Kirk in Illinois, who as a Republican has apologized on behalf of many of the offensive things that Donald Trump has said to minority communities, but also Terrence Cunningham, who is the president of the International Association of Police Chiefs, who has apologized for the historical mistreatment of minorities at the hands of the police. I want to give credit where credit's due, and I want to hope that other leaders in similar positions in law enforcement and politics also follow their lead and apologize accordingly.
Mickey Kaus.
Jean talks about structural factors to produce inequality. It's sort of hard to figure out what they are, but one of them is that we don't have a tight labor market at the bottom, as he says. The enemy of a tight labor market is new waves of workers. So immigration, which unfortunately the Democrats are bent on promoting, is the enemy of a tight labor market and the enemy of greater equality. I attack the Republican establishment for not pointing this out. They could have stopped Donald Trump if only they had said, okay, we're going to hold off on this immigration bill. He wouldn't have had an issue then. He would have faded in the background. All they had to do is put it on the back burner. But it's so important to corporate America to have this new wave of cheap workers that they pushed it and they got Donald Trump.
Gene Sperling.
My rant is for all the Republicans who decided that the only time they could distance themselves from Donald Trump was after the Access Hollywood, because they had daughters who would be affected. You know, I think in Passover we say Dayenu, that should be enough. When he mocked a reporter with disabilities, that should have been enough. When he started his campaign by calling Mexicans rapists and criminals, when he repeatedly did the build a wall chant, when he attacked a judge because he was of Mexican descent, when he attacked the cons, when he banned Muslims, that should have been enough. It shouldn't be about whether somebody in your family is being attacked. It should be about whether anybody is being discriminated against.
Woo! My rant is about Paul Ryan's sad blue eyes. I'm so sick of Paul Ryan's sad blue eyes. We have watched not just Paul Ryan, but men like Marco Rubio, who called Donald Trump a con artist and an erratic individual who could not be trusted with nuclear weapons, and Ted Cruz, who called Donald Trump utterly amoral and a pathological liar, and who incidentally seemed to get angry when Donald Trump insinuated that his wife was ugly and that his father had helped to kill JFK. All these men decided to endorse Donald Trump for president. They're not fools like Ben Carson. They know better. They know that if Donald Trump became president, he would pose, as Meg Whitman said, a grave danger to the Republic. But they endorsed him anyway for reasons of careerism or of cowardice or of strategy to position themselves for runs in 2020. And what it says to me is that they love their own political careers more than they love America. So I'm really hoping that after November 9, we can pay a lot less attention to Donald Trump. I'm really looking forward to writing him out of the political discourse. I'm not sure we'll succeed. But these people, these collaborationists, deserve to be just as gone as him. And it makes me so angry. It's a reason I left the Republican Party, because I couldn't deal with watching these people put the country at risk like that. There are good men like John Kasich, and Ben Sasse and Jeff Flake and people who knew better and stood up at political risk. And Mitt Romney. Although Mitt Romney went to Trump's hotel in 2012 to accept his endorsement after he was running around about the birth certificate. So two cheers for Mitt Romney. I'm not going to give him three. But anyway, that just makes me angry. We're over time. That's all we have time for tonight. I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight and tuning into this special live broadcast, Left, Right, and Center. I want to thank Gene Sperling, Mona Charon, Kelly Goff, Mickey Kaus, Margie O'Meara, and Leslie Sanchez. Thank you to our hosts, to our live audience here at the theater at the Ace Hotel. Laura Dine Million produced tonight's program. Our live event was produced by Aaron Sine and the KCRW events team. Our technical director is Phil Richards, backed by KCRW's chief engineer, Steve Herbert, and engineer Duncan Brode. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in every Friday on KCRW 89.9 and KCRW.com at 2:30 and 7 p.m. Pacific for more Left, Right, and Center. Good night, everybody. Yeah.